y'all may be seated.
We have one matter set for argument at this time. I understand the parties are here and counsel's here. And let me introduce your panel. I am Wade Birdwell, Justice Birdwell. To my right is Justice Walker. And then to my left, sitting by designation, is we will refer to him as Justice Gonzalez, Ruben Gonzalez, even though he is judge of the 432nd District Court. But we'll refer to him as Justice today. I think the earlier argument, somebody referred to him as Justice/Judge. So we'll cut that additional part, and I'll approve his reference as a justice. Let's leave it at that. So anyway, if you would go ahead and call the case. Thank you.
The court will now call Allison Publications, LLC, versus Jane Doe. It may please the court, Mr. Christopher Knight to argue for the appellant, Mr. Tommy McDonald to argue for the appellant.
May it please the court. I want to start by focusing the court on the novelty of the anonymous relief awarded below. The trial court granted dismissal with prejudice and awarded attorney's fees and sanctions to a completely anonymous party, unknown to the court, unknown to Allison, and unknown even to her own lawyer. Such anonymous litigation lacks legal precedent. Doe has cited no authority, not in Texas, not anywhere else in the nation, to support such a judgment. As far as Allison can tell, there is none. I want to focus on two basic reasons that the court should reverse the trial court here. First, neither Texas law nor policy permits completely anonymous litigation, much less completely anonymous relief. This error requires reversal of both the trial court's judgment and its refusal to identify Doe. Second, regardless of the anonymity issues, Allison has met its burden on the merits under the TCPA, and so dismissal was improper in any event. So I want to start with the anonymous litigation, anonymous relief point. As mentioned, there's no authority, not anywhere in the country. What Doe is asking for is essentially a new constitutional right or a quasi-constitutional right to anonymously litigate. So Texas law and the First Amendment do give someone sued for anonymous speech options, but there are two options, and they're exclusive of each other. Either you can defend anonymously or you can litigate under your real identity, but you can't do both. Doe wants to have her cake and eat it too, though. So while anonymity can be a shield for First Amendment speech, there's no independent right to anonymously wield your anonymity as a sword in litigation. And remember, and this is important, that Doe is here by choice. We never served her. We never named her as a party in this case. We never hailed her into court. She appeared before we had even issued the third-party subpoena.
Well, name a Jane Doe.
Well, yes, we did name.
As a party, you initiated litigation against somebody who you could not identify, and you did so in a reasonably accepted manner by referring to them as Jane Doe, but with the hope of identifying that individual, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, so to the extent that you were able to accurately identify her, you did, in fact, sue her if, in fact, we're dealing with a her.
That's correct, and that kind of gets to the point is that the Jane Doe, when you file a suit against the Jane Doe, it's really a placeholder if you don't know the identity of the party you're meaning to sue. And then you do some discovery, so we were serving third-party subpoenas, trying to uncover her identity. But before we even got to uncovering her identity, she inserted herself in this lawsuit, filed a TCPA motion, and sought affirmative relief.
And let me just stop you. So the reason you reached out to the phone companies to get the identity,
correct,
was so that hopefully you could name this person and then serve her.
Correct. That's correct. And so we would have done that had that been the case. And I want to say that the only cases that even tangentially discuss this anonymous litigation reject it. I would point the court to the United States versus Microsoft case out of the D.C. Circuit in our brief. And there the court says we are not aware of any case in which a plaintiff was allowed to sue a defendant and remain anonymous to that defendant. Such proceedings would seriously implicate due process. And that's exactly right. When you don't know who you're litigating against, you don't know who your adversary is, you're fighting against the ghost. That violates basic fairness. It makes it impossible for us to strategize in this case, to really test our opponent at all. There's a right to know your accuser in litigation. And so I want the court to consider the declaration too in reference to this. of course, we'd say the declaration here, Doe's declaration, is not admissible at all. It doesn't comply with the statutory requirements. The jurat is with penalty of perjury to Jane Doe pseudonym, which there's no penalty of perjury when it's you don't know who the person attesting to perjury is. And so as Jane Doe said in the trial court, any attempt to enforce anything against her would be a farce, and that's exactly what this declaration is. It's mostly indicative of the bigger problems with the anonymous litigation in this case. There's really no means to test, no accountability, and the Justice Scalia has said in the McIntyre case that we cite in these cases that that anonymity facilitates wrong by eliminating accountability, and that's exactly what we have here. There's other problems too. It's impossible to know whether we're paying a real party. So we're paying. We have a judgment against us to an anonymous Jane Doe. The court could imagine anyone could jump into a lawsuit. We sue a placeholder. Some random person could jump into the lawsuit, file a TCPA motion, and obtain a judgment against us. And if what Doe is saying is right, they would be able to do that.
I don't remember, but the judgment itself. What was the? Who were y'all ordered to pay money to specifically?
So we were ordered to pay money to the law office of Tony McDonald for the benefit of Jane Doe. If the court considers what the flip side of if we had won the TCPA motion here, how could we enforce that? Maybe we could do some post-judgment discovery to try to figure out who Jane Doe was. But what if we discovered the Jane Doe and she says, I'm not the person who's been litigating against you? I mean, there's
how does the bank negotiate that check if it's made out to counsel and to Jane Doe?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure, Your Honor.
Just a question. Okay.
But it wasn't actually ordered that it was for the benefit of Jane Doe. So you were technically writing the check to the law firm and the law firm.
That's correct. That's right.
They weren't a necessary party to execution.
That's right. And other problems, too, that we've mentioned in our briefing, there could be binding precedent created between completely unknown parties. We think there's a case in controversy here. We brought a case knowing that there's a case in controversy against someone. But we don't know if the case in controversy is actually against the Jane Doe here, and there, perhaps it is. But it's impossible to know.
So let me stop you real fast because you're saying there's no authority. You're just coming up with all the arguments as to why this is a bad thing. Obviously, Appellee cited some cases mm-hmm. where there have been anonymous parties in litigation. How do you distinguish those?
Yeah, so I think all of Doe's cases fit into three general buckets. There's the pseudonymity cases, there's the First Amendment anonymous speech cases out of the U.S. Supreme Court, and then there's this Doe's 1-10 Cahill Dendrite cases. And so the pseudonymity cases, I think that's the most of the cases they cite are pseudonymity cases, and that's just fundamentally different. I think the court can get rid of those really easily. In those cases, the parties know who the synonymous party is. The court knows. So there's not all these due process problems, practical problems with a pseudonym case. And in any event, in those cases, it's not just a given that you get to proceed under a pseudonym. The exceptions are pretty severe, like a sexual assault of a minor.
Just to be authority for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just a given that you get to proceed synonymously. And so, Jane, I would say footnote 4 of Doe's brief, all of those cases are pseudonym cases. None of them support what she's asking for here. And then the second line of cases is the U.S. Supreme Court cases, and that would be like the McIntyre case, the Buckley case, the Watchtower case. And I would ask the court just look at the captions of those cases. None of them say V. Roe, V. Doe. They're all against named parties that are protecting, they're all about protecting a right to speak, not an anonymity generally. So those were all government regulations that were going to limit the party's ability to speak because it was requiring them to identify themselves. And so those are facial challenges. They're not dealing with anonymous litigation at all. And then the Doe's 1-10 cases.
Are those kind of like the, and they may actually include like the Klan case where they were ordered to, attorney was ordered to identify who his clients were and membership. The membership cases, I guess, is
like the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm not sure. I'm not familiar with that exact one, but that would be kind of the gist of it.
Okay.
And then the Doe's 1-10 Cahill. That's what the trial court purported to apply here in saying it wasn't going to unmask identify Doe. And I think I'd say the procedural posture in those cases is just very different. Those are the cases that perhaps would have come up, although I would say there's no governing standard in Texas, but perhaps that would have come up had we filed our third-party subpoena. Had we been able to kind of get to this point where we were about to discover Doe's identity, she could have come in, moved to quash, and then that standard would come up purely defensively, purely to protect her First Amendment right to speech. So it would say you can't discover her identity because that would this is First Amendment protected speech. And so that's very different than someone coming into litigation, seeking anonymous relief, seeking to litigate against you anonymously.
Is there something about those cases where there is an expectation of confidentiality that has to be demonstrated by the Doe? In other words, it's, for example, posted on a website that doesn't require identity type of thing, so there's an expectation of privacy as opposed to picking up the phone and making a call to a business to disparage somebody they're doing business with.
Well, yes, in most of those cases, they'd be, you know, some of them are, a lot of them are internet cases, so the subpoenas are going to ISPs, not to this phone number host. But they would be, they would be posting anonymously on those sites. Their identity wouldn't be generally known, so they would be expecting privacy in whatever they're saying.
That would also depend upon what the agreement is with regard to the use of that particular service.
I think that would be right, Your Honor. I don't know if that's discussed in any of the case law. Certainly, there are different factors. I mean, one of the main factors is kind of, do you have a case? Because, of course, business disparagement, defamation is not protected by the First Amendment. So if you can show you have a facial case, then that's not going to be protected anyway. And so that's usually the basis alone for saying, you know, you're not going to be able to maintain your anonymity in this lawsuit. But when Doe came in and decided to litigate against us, it's not just that there's no authority. She subjected herself to Texas law requirements. Civil Practice and Remedies Code Section 30015 says that parties must identify themselves when they file their initial pleading. And there's exceptions, again, for sexual assaults, sexual assault of minors. Those parties can proceed under a pseudonym. But there's not an exception for anything that Doe's arguing here. And again, these provisions don't apply to the motion to quash that Doe could have filed. That can be filed by any affected party, or not even party, affected person, under the statute governing motion to quash. And she could have also filed a special appearance, which she did. And that's under subsection B of 30015. It says that a special appearance, the statute does not apply to a special appearance. And these provisions aren't anything remarkable. They're common in states and in the federal courts, and they really just bring Texas law in line with the universal practice and the due process basic fairness requirements. In the Microsoft case, again, there's a provision governing amici, and the D.C. Circuit says, said that provision required the amici to identify themselves, and then it went on to say, you know, this is a due process problem if they're not identified.
Let me ask you a question real quick about special appearances. Obviously, attorneys, we all generally know what a special appearance is typically used for, and it's a pretty limited situation normally. And you're fighting jurisdiction. You're trying to say, hey, this court doesn't have jurisdiction over me. Did you find any really good case law on the limitations of special appearances? And why those limitations might go in your favor?
Well, I would say actually, you know, it's Doe has waived her special appearance here, so we don't have a special appearance at issue. There is one case dealing with anonymous special appearances, which is the Trooper case out of the Texas Supreme Court, and in that case, Justice Lehrman in dissent said that the court has basically made it impossible to sue an anonymous party because they can always file a special appearance, and it's impossible to show personal jurisdiction over someone who you don't know who they are. I think here maybe we'd have some arguments that we could.
What was the remedy fashioned by the majority in that case?
So in that case, it was the court granted the special appearance, so the case had to be dismissed.
So does that stand for the proposition that if the parties are not identified, that the trial court doesn't have personal jurisdiction and therefore cannot proceed. If the court's going to say you can bring a special appearance anonymously and your remedy is dismissal of the lawsuit, why could we not infer from that in fact dismissal is the appropriate thing here if we don't have an actual party that we know who they are?
I don't think that's a fair point. I don't know how the court could. I mean here part of the problem perhaps is that personal jurisdiction is waivable and it's usually a defensive mechanism. But
is there any authority that you can waive it without knowing who's actually waiving it?
Well, typically it would be the defendant that's waiving it for themselves, not the plaintiff.
Is there some reason why you didn't file in the trial court a motion to show authority that counsel actually had authority to represent somebody named Jane Doe in the court?
I do not know the answer to that, but I can follow up if the court would like.
Okay.
And you said that the special appearance was waived. You're arguing that, correct? That wasn't something that the appellate conceded.
They've waived their special appearance. So they pulled down their special appearance at a hearing, and entered a general appearance.
Okay.
So that was what I was kind of referring to, is that they typically would be the defendant. And I don't believe that's what you're asking about. I don't believe that's in the record that we've objected in any way to that. But
okay. But the general appearance is a conditional general appearance, conditioned on whether or not they identify themselves. Correct. I'm making a general appearance, but I'm actually not going to appear. I'm only going to appear through counsel, and counsel is representing that he has authority, but that was never tested in the trial court. Is that correct?
That's right, and that's kind of what the 3015 would go to, is that when you appear.
Do we have the authority up here to demand authority with regard to representation before this court, or do you know the answer to that?
I'm not sure I know the answer to that. I think the court could certainly ask that, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure what specific trap provision would provide that authority.
Okay.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
Sure. Counsel, on what authority are you before us today?
So as the record here shows, we entered an appearance on behalf of Jane Doe, also entered a declaration stating.
How do we know that?
Rule 13, Your Honor. So Rule 13 requires that attorneys who sign pleadings do so truthfully.
How are we to test the veracity of your pleading?
Well, I think you have to trust trial court judges to manage those proceedings. And
but you're before us now, counsel.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay. So how are we to trust your certification to this court that you actually have a client that you're representing if we cannot verify who the client is?
Well, the answer is, again, Rule 13, but then the general requirement that I be truthful with the court as an officer of the court.
Okay. So we're to take your say-so on it.
Yes, Your Honor, and
until it might be challenged. If it's challenged, if it's put in contest, then on what basis are we to take your say-so for it?
Well, I think that's the key issue. If it were put in contest, if it were challenged, then we would need to potentially do more to paper up the record that there is a client.
Would not the appeal on the basis that the court didn't have jurisdiction to enter the order because we don't know who the actual party is, would that not contest your authority?
I'm sorry, I missed the first part of your statement.
Would not an appeal that contests the entire judgment that was entered here on the basis that the person in favor of whom the judgment was entered, including damages, money damages, is not identified and therefore is not subject to execution or anything else, would that not place your authority to represent Jane Doe, whomever he or she may be, in issue?
No, Your Honor. There was no Rule 12 motion in the trial court. There has been no motion before this Court of Appeals with regard to my authority to represent my client. And so,
would it not be a jurisdictional issue that we could bring up sua sponte?
No, I don't disagree with that.
So,
I think the court certainly could.
So if I ordered you to tell me who your party, your client is today, how would you respond to that?
Well, I can tell you a lot about my client, but I have intentionally avoided learning her name. I have met her. And so if there were a motion sua sponte from the court on this issue, certainly we would bring, I would think, a declaration or affidavit from me describing the process of meeting my client and assessing the litigation.
And it would ultimately say it's an impossibility. You don't even know who it is, so you couldn't tell us.
That's incorrect.
But we're going behind this veil, trying to find out who this person is. We don't even know if you have a contractual relationship with the person.
Well, that's not accurate. The record here shows that I submitted a declaration on the attorney's fee issue, and in that declaration, I tell the court, I told the trial court, and you can see this from the record here, I have a client who I have retained. It is the person at issue in this case.
That was a Freudian right there.
Excuse me?
You just said, I have a client who I have retained.
Or excuse me, that she has, she has retained.
Which is kind of the point here.
She has retained.
That's one of our concerns.
That's one of our concerns.
Do you have even settlement authority? Do you have anything to litigate on behalf of somebody at this point? It drives home the issue in terms of, you know, even in the pseudonyms that they talk about in the context of the criminal court, everybody knows the identity of the person that's being utilized in the pseudonym. Because then you can evaluate their character, you can evaluate the basis for her claim or his claim, what have you.
I think there's a mistake and a misunderstanding from the record here, and this has been advanced by the appellants in this case, that I don't know who my client is. I know I've met the client.
I'm sure you do, Ken.
Yes.
So we're yanking your chain just a little bit. Yeah.
Who do we write the check out to?
to make the point that at some point in time, the court has to have some idea of who they're actually granting relief to for it to be subject to execution. What stops me from affirming this judgment on behalf of your client, and then as soon as the mandate issues, I go down and file a motion to execute and identify myself through an attorney who I've hired as anonymous, and then how the heck is the trial court going to make a determination between your client anonymous and me as the anonymous client of the attorney I choose to go down and try and get $10,000 or however much the judgment is by that point in time?
The answer is I think we have to trust trial courts to manage these issues in these unique type of cases. And that's what Judge Johnson did here, order that the payment be made to the client trust account, the IOLTA account of my firm, to then be paid to the anonymous party. And you got to remember the appellants talk here about novelty. But the novelty was created when they engaged in a fishing expedition on wafer-thin allegations to unmask a critic. They created this novelty, and to say
something that your client could have avoided altogether since they didn't know who it was and would never have been subject to jurisdiction, you invited it by walking in and saying, I represent this individual, we'll make a general appearance on this individual's behalf, and therefore we're subject although we're not going to identify him or her, we're going to not only subject ourselves to the jurisdiction of the trial court, we're going to ask for affirmative relief on the basis of not Rule 91A and the TCPA.
There's a reason for the strategy. You have to bear in mind that it's not just a discovery motion. They have filed a lawsuit seeking damages, significant damages, against my client and are seeking to unmask my client, not only depriving her of her anonymity and the choice to be anonymous in her speech, but they have chosen to proceed to seek damages against her.
Let me ask you this. How does the TCPA even remotely apply? Because it requires the infringement of those three rights. Okay, if she doesn't appear.
So
they never find out who she is. There's nothing infringing about trying to do the discovery.
I disagree.
Okay, and what authority do you have for making that disagreement?
So specifically, the attempt to unmask is itself a deprivation of a First Amendment right. It's something that is as recognized initially in the Dendrite decision and then in Cahill by the New Jersey Court of Appeals, followed by the Texarkana Court of Appeals here in Texas in Does 1 through 10. And by our count,
they had done privately, instead of seeking the subpoena authority of the trial court, if they had simply put a private investigator on it, you're saying that that would have been a violation of her First Amendment or his First Amendment rights?
Well, it would that would have the goal of stripping away the anonymity. Now, that would not be illegitimate. That would be something that would be in the wild. But what the Cahill and its and that line of cases tells us is that in order for a litigant to come before a court and ask a court to unmask, to use the tools of the civil justice process to unmask a critic, that court must examine the pleadings and find that the party has a prima facie case, that they have a case that passes muster. And the trial court here simply found that they did not, because, again, this is a fishing expedition based around wafer-thin allegations of a bald accusation of racism, unsupported by any facts. So it would be a deprivation of First Amendment rights. Secondly, I would direct the court to Hirsch v. Tatum. The Supreme Court's gave us instruction about when does the TCPA apply. And it tells us first to look at the allegations in the pleading. In Hirsch, the defendant there denied making the statements at issue alleged in the petition. And the Supreme Court said, that's okay. You can deny that you ever made the statements, and indeed in this case we do deny that the statements, D Magazine is racist, that sort of thing, were ever made. You can deny that, but we look at whether the TCPA applies based on the allegations contained in the pleading. And so when we look at the allegations here, we have an allegation that a person has made comment about the whether a prominent local newspaper is racist or not. That is a matter of public concern under the statute. And in fact, D Magazine brought the declaration of Tim Rogers, its editor, before the court, and he said, not only is this of interest to the advertisers, it's of such interest in the community that if the advertisers continued to do business with us, they would lose customers. And so the only evidence that we have in addition to the pleadings is that the TCPA applies.
Okay, so again, the TCPA is intended to protect the rights of individuals. Okay. It's not to protect the speech itself, the statement itself. It's to protect the right of the individual to make that statement. How is the TCPA implicated if the party that is supposedly trying to shut down the right of an individual to communicate can never be identified?
Well, I don't think this is a case where they can never be identified. The plaintiffs here were attempting to identify this party through phone records and that sort of subpoena power. So you do have someone here who could be identified if the discovery process were abused.
Basically, if somebody who has effectively intervened, saying, okay, they don't know who I am, but I'm going to go ahead and file a general answer so that I can deny that I'm the person they're looking at because I never said what they say I said.
Well, I would say not.
So there's a denial, so we don't know who they are, and on top of that, there's denial of who the, I mean, the litigation itself, they can do everything they want until it actually starts implicating the rights of your client.
So I would look at it much differently, and I think my client looked at it much differently. A lawsuit has been filed against her, seeking damages against her. It's seeking to strip her of her anonymity, her efforts to use a pseudonym to strip her of that anonymity. And it wasn't an intervention. It's an answer, and it's an answer that says, hey, I'm here, and I think this case fails as a matter of both law and fact. And that really is the key issue here that the trial court zoomed in on, and I'd like to zoom this court in on. Is a bald accusation of racism actionable under defamation law? The only Texas court that I know of that's looked at this was Baker v. Orange Panda, the San Antonio Court of Appeals, a couple of years ago, and they sidestepped the issue. So this is a matter that is fresh to the state, although I will say this, it has been dealt with in other states. I love this quote from New York. In daily life, racist is hurled about so indiscriminately that it is no more than a verbal slap in the face.
Counselor, and obviously, that in reasonable minds could differ on that, right? I mean, obviously, we live in a hypersensitive society, and claims of racism can be a really jarring thing. It can cause damage. It can. But I don't even really want to go there. I want to back up real quick. So you have the parties. They file a lawsuit. You were talking about everything that's in the petition and how you have to look to the pleadings itself. But they're suing for defamation. Then as a part of their suit for defamation, they start discovery. They're not suing to try to find out who she is. They're suing because they're claiming that somebody defamed them and their institution. And in the process, through discovery, they're asking for the identity of this person to be disclosed. Then you get hired to come in to file at first a special appearance, which becomes a general appearance. Almost could be arguably look like an intervention. But then you come in and you basically say, we don't want to be identified. And at the same time, we want attorney's fees. We want this dismissed. You filed the TCPA motion, and that's the vehicle in which it was dismissed.
Correct.
And so the court's looking at the TCPA standards, and they're asking the questions of whether or not it applies. And one of the first primary requirements on the TCPA is that there had to be something that was actionable. There had to be something that was either a right to petition, or there had to be some kind of communication. But when we have a person who we don't even know who they are, how can a trial court ultimately determine that one of those things are met? That's the question I have.
Well, first of all, I'd remind the court that the trial court was comfortable that the TCPA applied in this case. I mean, these were argued below. And
there's a difference between application and whether or not the standards are met. I mean, whether are you saying that they actually – obviously, he went through, apparently, and looked at them, but –
The record supports that the act applies, and it's through two ways. There's a kind of front door and a back door. The front door is, are the statements alleged in the amended petition a matter of public concern? Is, you know, the question of whether D Magazine is racist or whether its editor is racist, is that a matter that would be of interest to the public? So if it is, then the act applies. The second way, the back door, is through 27010B. Here you have, and it's both supported by the declaration of Doe coming from my client, but also from the evidence brought in and the allegations brought in by the plaintiffs, that the person who made the phone calls represented themselves to be a freelance writer who was collecting comment from these advertisers.
That's what your Jane Doe alleges.
She testifies to that through the declaration, and then that is supported with less detail by the appellants themselves. And so to the extent that we have a record that shows that she was engaged in gathering comment for a news publication, regardless of whether it's published or not, I mean, 27010B is incredibly broad, then we find that the act applies.
The appellant, and I'm paraphrasing here, but in essence, one of the things that they argue is that there has never been a situation in the history of mankind in the state of Texas where someone has come forward anonymously, filed a TCPA motion to dismiss, had that motion to dismiss, and their identity continued to be masked throughout the whole TCPA proceeding.
See, and that's
do you agree with that?
That's totally incorrect. So I can cite two examples. This is there's a novelty anytime you have a Jane Doe case. There's not that many of them. But the glass door case, you had two Does bring a TCPA motion. Supreme Court made no comment on whether the propriety of those anonymous parties bringing a TCPA motion. They didn't
rule.
Was
that issue raised?
I don't think it was raised, but there was no comment on it. The second one is out of the Third Court of Appeals in NRE Elliott. You had an anonymous party there move under the TCPA. And again, that case really dealt with some more ancillary issues related to the discovery stay and whether the motion kicked off the discovery stay. They didn't go into depth about whether an anonymous party could bring a TCPA motion. But again, those two courts, those are two examples where this has happened before in somewhat similar circumstances. I'd also point the court to the Trapper case. The Trapper case goes to the Texas Supreme Court. There you have an anonymous party submitting anonymous, John Doe affidavits to the court. And again, the Supreme Court does not object to that, and it sustains the special exception.
That's not a TCPA case, correct?
That was not a TCPA. It was a special appearance case.
Right. I've had a problem with the TCPA from the beginning in that the initial TCPA was predicated upon affidavits, and the third step was the determination by preponderance of the evidence that there was an affirmative defense. Okay. That is an adjudication of an affirmative defense on affidavits without the ability of the trial court to determine the credibility of the witness, which is a fundamental, that's a separation of powers issue, fundamental function of the trial court. Here it's related in that the legislature's now essentially said, well, we'll kind of bring in the summary judgment rule with regard to how the evidence is presented. But even under the summary judgment standard, okay, you can't get a summary judgment based upon the evidence, the affidavit evidence of an interested witness, period, okay, because it has to be subject to contravention. And under these circumstances, how are they to controvert when they don't know who they're dealing with? How can the trial court make a credibility determination with regard to the evidence in front of it without knowing who that individual is? It seems to me this is resurrecting the separation of powers issues that I've had some worries about.
So two responses on that. One real quick is, as far as I can tell, every constitutional challenge to the TCPA so far has failed. The statute
has never been a separation of powers argument.
Fair enough, but these constitutional challenges to the Act have failed.
I've even talked to Justice Pemberton down in Austin about it two or three years ago.
I think that if the appellants here wanted to make a constitutional challenge to the application of the TCPA in these circumstances, they could have done so. I don't think they have done so.
Let's leave the Constitution out of it, okay? Summary judgment law, we can't grant summary judgment. Trial court can't grant summary judgment based upon the affidavit of an interested witness on testimony that is not subject to contravention.
Out of time, but may I respond to your question?
You may respond.
The difference here is, again, we're not the plaintiff. We're the defendant and just the movement. And the burden here with regard to affidavit evidence, with regard to this prima facie case under the summary judgment standard under the TCPA, that's the burden of the appellants.
Well, does that not raise a due process issue when the appellants are the ones who have to raise by clear and specific evidence, but they can't depose your client? They can't obtain evidence from your client, which might reasonably,
undermine the confidence of what they're saying.
So basically, it's kind of a king's X from your client that you've sued me. I am uniquely qualified to testify about what I did, when I did, et cetera, but you can't tell me. I'm not going to tell you who you are. Therefore, you're left to your own devices as to trying to figure out. And the court, and it also leaves the court to the court's own devices about this. And so that was my question. It's along the lines of, if we can't do it in the summary judgment context, how can we do that here? And does that not demonstrate the difficulty with the anonymity with regard to the TCPA?
May I respond briefly?
Sure.
I think even if you throw out Doe's declaration, the decision of the trial court should be sustained or should be affirmed here in terms of the dismissal. Mainly I leave you at that. Even if you exclude that, the record's overwhelming here. And they didn't bring – they could have brought the advertisers, to say what actually was said and what actually went on. That didn't happen here. I mean, it's, again, a wafer-thin allegations – wafer-thin evidence, a hearsay objection sustained, I basically didn't
You're
bring
not a Monty Python fan, are you?
I love Monty Python.
Wafer thin.
Thank
meaning
you.
Of life. I'm sorry, the reference is to the meaning of life for those who are not so informed. You have a question?
I do, and okay. You know, it's just, I know your time's up, but I've got to get out there. Do you realize that if we were to affirm this and basically, you know, potentially make law here, there's an argument that we may have a situation where crafty attorneys could get involved, come in, pretend that they have an anonymous client, or maybe even we also have situations have somebody who's not even really, you know, really doesn't even have standing to come in and then maintain the anonymity, and the courts never really know if a great injustice had been taken because there's never any identification of the party.
My answer to that is I think we have to trust trial courts to manage these contingencies.
But if they don't know, then, I mean, we're it's not like we're the ones who are – everybody, nobody in the process, including the trial judge, doesn't know.
Well, it starts with whether the plaintiff has a prima facie case, has a real case, and then you can work on unmasking that anonymous party. If they don't have a real case, well, then that case shouldn't be there. And that's the problem here. Whenever you have a case on virtually non-existent allegations, what starts on non-existent allegations and then wafer-thin allegations of a bald accusation of racism, it's not actionable. It's a legally and factually deficient case.
Is there an actual case that says a bald accusation of racism is not actionable as
defamation? It was one in San Antonio.
Well, to answer the question, so Baker v. Orange Panda sidesteps that question. So a Texas case, I would direct the court to Scripps. Texas Supreme Court in Scripps tells us if something is not falsifiable, it's not actionable.
Okay. All righty. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Would you give two additional minutes for rebuttal, please?
And please, the court. I just have a few points in rebuttal. Justice Walker, to your point, I didn't hear anything that my friend over here said that suggests that the court would not have to make new law, break new ground to rule for Doe here to allow this anonymous litigation. The court would absolutely have to go out on a limb, do something that no other court has done before. I heard him talk about two cases. One is the Glassdoor case, and one is the Elliott case out of Austin, and as he mentioned, neither of those cases addressed this issue. It was not argued. It was not objected to. And as the court knows, when parties aren't objecting to issues, they're typically not going to be addressed. Especially as
let me interject. Those are the two TCPA cases, correct?
Correct.
And basically, what your point is that. He can actually put those cases forward for the proposition that there have been instances where somebody filed a TCPA motion that was anonymous, but those cases do not stand for the proposition that that is okay or that they should get relief. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the Glassdoor case, I would also say that the TCPA motion was filed by Glassdoor, so that was an identified party. That I think that deals with some of the due process problems that we're talking about here, because there was an identified opponent in the litigation. The Does joined into that motion, and nobody objected to that. It wasn't addressed in the trial court. It wasn't addressed in the Court of Appeals. The Texas Supreme Court said dismissed the case for a completely different reason. And actually, the other point in that case is that no relief was ever granted either. So the trial court denied the TCPA motion, the Court of Appeals affirmed, and then the Texas Supreme Court dismissed the case. And so I also didn't hear, you know, the why Doe doesn't have to comply with the same rules as everyone else when she litigates in Texas. The Texas Civil Practice and Normative Code, as I mentioned, clearly requires a litigant to identify themselves when they file their first motion or first pleading. I didn't hear an answer to that. And the court asked a number of questions. Another point, the court asked a number of questions on contracts and fees and those sorts of things. I think that just goes to the point of why this is. It certainly shows the practical problems with anonymous litigation.
Now, we can't – there is authority, and the legislature has provided some authority for granting judgments to Jane Does. We've got the judicial bypass statute. We have other instances where the court has allowed that type of thing, but in each of those instances, the judge knows who they're dealing with.
Right, right. I think that goes to the difference between the pseudonym and anonymity. And as the court is reviewing that authority, I would say there's some mixing and matching of those terms, but the cases are clear, you know, what they're talking about. They're talking about anonymous as to the, you know, the public, which has its own set of concerns. It's open courts, issues with public access, the press's access to the courts, and then as between the parties and the court. And as to the latter, there's just not authority for that.
What is your authority to counter my question to counsel that racism can, a bald accusation of racism is in fact subject to a defamation claim?
Right. So I would say, you know, the court, we're not just saying, you know, a bald accusation of racism is always a defamation claim. Certainly, as my friend cites over here, that there are cases saying that sometimes it can be a verbal slap in the face. But what they're failing to recognize and is the authority, the Milkovich case, the Bentley case, and those cases say that a statement is actionable if it implies the existence of underlying facts but does not disclose those facts. And so the Milkovich case uses an example. It says that if a speaker says, in my opinion, John Jones is a liar, he implies a knowledge of facts which leads to the conclusion that Jones told an untruth. And that's exactly what we have here.
Tell me again what court that is.
The U.S. Supreme Court.
Oh, yeah.
And that's exactly what we have here. Doe is saying that Allison is a racist organization, and that implies a knowledge of facts that lead to that at least imply that.
Is there any case law with regard to possibly making a distinction with regard to the business disparagement aspect of defamation? In other words, the statement is made if it can be demonstrated, the statement is made with a clear intent to dissuade someone from doing business with the person who is identified as the racist. Does that change the context of whether or not that is simply an opinion as opposed to some type of weaponized statement that presumes there's evidence to support it for purposes of the damage to be done?
Well, I would say, you know, typically courts view defamation and business disparagement as fairly interchangeable. Certainly this aspect of whether a statement is actionable is protected by the First Amendment or not, is typically interchangeable, but context is key in business disparagement and defamation cases. And here the context is someone calling our advertisers. She claims to be a journalist. Of course, we're saying that the declaration that says that is no evidence. But calling our advertisers and saying, this organization is a racist organization. You should stop doing business with them. And a reasonable advertiser would take that statement to think that there is some reason for the statement. It's not like someone yelling out, driving by in their car, yelling, you know, you're a racist. It's
and advertisers, you know, they don't have legal training. They're not going to respond and say, oh, well, that was a conclusory statement. You know, you have no assertions to justify that statement.
Right.
They will just assume, is what you're saying, is that there must be some reason that this person's reached this conclusion.
Right. And we would say it's certainly not a verbal slap in the face. It's not rhetorical hyperbole. I think Doe suggests that there's a slippery slope that we're saying accusations of racism are always actionable. And that's simply not the case. We're just saying, you know, look at the context, apply the Milkovich case, and this statement is actionable. But the opposite, if accusations of racism are never actionable, is problematic. That is a slippery slope. And just look at this case. She's anonymously accused us of racism, and there's no way, according to her arguments, there's no way we can figure out who she is. There's no way we can obtain any relief. And she can, with impunity, with no accountability at all, accuse us of being a racist company. That's not the way the civil justice system is supposed to work. The TCPA itself recognizes that it makes way for meritorious claims. And we would ask the court to reverse the trial court judgment and remand for non-anonymous proceedings.
I've got a quick question.
Yes.
I know your time's close to being up. But, you know, the thing that I keep thinking is, you know, what keeps, if we affirm, what keeps us from creating basically jurisprudence, our permission slip, for bad actors to file TCPA motions, maintain their anonymity, and then turn around and seek. You know, the thing is Appellee says we have to give faith, but
they start asking for thousands of dollars in attorney's fees, that's a lot of faith. And, you know, how do you respond to that, I guess, in your final statement?
Well, I completely agree with that concern. Is it's not just no accountability. It's a reward for misbehavior. And sure, we can trust attorneys to diligently do their job. And I'm not saying that there's been bad faith here. But you don't know. That's the problem, is we don't know.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The matter is submitted, and we stand adjourned. Thank you.